So, last time I tried to show you that it may make sense to assign a finite number to the sum, now in quotation marks, okay, of a divergent series. Okay, of course, it may also be perfectly reasonable to say is a finite number. And
let me, I guess, right. So let me give you a sort of model of the kind of physical problem that ultimately we would like to discuss, okay? So you have had some exposure to quantum field theory, okay? And you know, you've studied, you've seen what a functional integral is, right? You're nodding your heads reluctantly. But you've seen things like this, you know, d phi e to the minus action, okay, action. And so for a phi to the 4 field theory, which is usually the field theory that you get, that gets discussed especially in when you're teaching this stuff, you learn that it's something like dx, and this could be a d-dimensional integration. Okay, it might be d4x or something like that. And then there's some grad phi squared and an m squared phi squared and a g phi to the 4, something like that. Okay? And this is very fancy, okay, because this depends on knowing what you mean by a functional integral, which is very fancy mathematics. But we can take a simple model of this problem and study it in great depth. Okay, so what I mean by a simple model would be, instead of working in d dimensions where d equals 4, why don't we work in the simple case where d equals 0? Okay, d equals 1 would be quantum mechanics. Okay, 1 means just time. But we could take the dimension to be 0. And of course, if the dimension is 0, this integral goes away. We're in a universe with just one space-time point in it, just one. And of course, this derivative becomes irrelevant. Okay? And for simplicity, let's take that mass to be 1. Why not? Pretty simple thing to do. So this, and of course, if we're in, you learned that this thing here means an infinite product of ordinary integrals, one for each space-time point, you know, d phi I, product over I, all the different space-time points. But if the universe is zero-dimensional, there's only one space-time point, just one point. So this reduces to an integral of the form dx e to the minus x squared over 2 minus gx to the 4th. Okay? That's it. That's the integral. Okay? So this is an ordinary freshman calculus integral. And it would be very interesting to study this in great detail, because you're going to see what I mean by summing a divergent series, okay, and why a divergent series arises, and so on. Okay? So I think a nice, simple thing to do would be to multiply this by the square root of 2 over pi. Okay, I don't have to do that, of course. But there's a reason why I might want to do that. What's the reason? It's just that when g is equal to 0, the coupling constant is equal to 0, then, you have a Gaussian integral, and that Gaussian integral integrates to the square root of pi over 2. So it'll cancel the square root of 2 over pi, and it'll give 1. Okay. So this is some integral here. What we can call it I. Okay. And it depends on the coupling constant g. Okay. But this is not how you would be presented with the theory. How would you be presented with the theory? You would be given this. Okay. Okay. And this is an integral that is too difficult to do by freshman calculus methods. So if someone walks up to you on the street and says, how do you evaluate that integral? This is from, you know, from minus infinity to infinity, something like that. Or from 0. Let's integrate from 0 to infinity. Okay? Because it's an even function, so it doesn't matter. Okay. So if someone comes up to you on the street and says, you know, what does this integral evaluate to? You would say, well, I can't do the integral. It's just some integral, so I'll just leave it in the form of an integral. Okay? And the best I can do, you say, is to evaluate this numerically. And the guy in the street says, yeah, but can't you do anything perturbatively? And you say, well, I could insert a perturbation parameter. I could put a small perturbation parameter over here, epsilon. Okay? And this would be called strong coupling. Okay, that's a strong coupling approximation. But that's not a great idea. Why? Because when epsilon is equal to 0, you still can't evaluate the integral in simple terms. You can evaluate it, of course, but not in simple terms, we'll say. Okay. So you might want to instead put the epsilon over here. Okay? And now you would like to perturbatively evaluate this integral. Okay? So if you do that, here's a straightforward, simple way of going about doing this. You would say, this is the integral from 0 to infinity, dx, e to the minus x squared over 2. And then I can evaluate this as a series in powers of epsilon. What we are doing when we evaluate this as a series in powers of epsilon is actually summing a bunch of Feynman diagrams. Okay? That is not obvious. This should not be obvious to you, but I will explain that next week. I think I'd like to spend some time on Feynman diagrams because they're very interesting. Okay? But let's suppose you've never heard of Feynman diagrams. It's very easy to evaluate this perturbatively because all I need to do is to expand the exponential of e to the minus epsilon x to the 4. If I do that, I get 1 minus epsilon x to the 4 plus epsilon squared x to the 8th over 2 factorial and so on. Right? And then I integrate term by term. Okay? So the first term in this series is the integral of e to the minus x squared over 2 times 1 times the square root of 2 over pi, which is 1. Okay, that's the reason why I put in that square root of 2 over pi. Okay? And the next term, is that clear? I mean, this is the first term is the square root of 2 over pi integral dx e to the minus x squared over 2. The next term is minus the square root of 2 over pi integral from 0 to infinity dx e to the minus x squared over 2 times epsilon x to the 4, and so on. Okay? Yeah?
Sorry, going back to the beginning, why can't you just get rid of that integral in the exponent?
The integral. Why did I get rid of it?
Yeah.
Because I'm saying, let's pretend that this is a model of a quantum field theory, and we're in zero-dimensional space-time. If this were quantum mechanics, we would be in one-dimensional space-time. So here we'd be integrating over, this would be a one-dimensional integral, and it would be over time, just time. But we're saying there's no space and no time. So nothing is evolving. Okay? So this is just a point. The entire universe is just one single lattice point.
So this product of integrals over lattice points reduces to an ordinary integral, just dx. Okay, that's the formula. Yeah.
Wouldn't your first term be a half because you integrate from 0 to infinity?
Isn't this integral the square root of pi over 2? There's a 2 here.
But you don't have. But you only. Oh, maybe I'm.
No, minus.
Yeah? Right. Happy?
Yeah.
Okay. Alright. So now let's integrate term by term. And the question is, how do you do integrals of this form? How do you do that integral? And the answer is you just do that integral by parts. Okay? This integral is just done by parts. So in general, how do you integrate e to the minus, x squared over 2 times x to the 2n? How do you do that integral? What you do is you say, let me replace x to the 2n by x to the 2n minus 1 times x. Okay? And I differentiate x to the 2n minus 1, and I integrate x times e to the minus x squared over 2. And I repeatedly differentiate, integrate by parts. And each time when I differentiate this, okay, I get a factor of 2n minus 1 times the integral from 0 to infinity e to the minus x squared over 2 times x to the 2n minus 2. Okay, so you can see that I can just repeatedly integrate by parts. And each time I do an integration by parts, the power of x drops by 2. By 2 each time. So therefore, if I use that technique on this integral here, I get a factor of 3 and then 1. So this gives me 3 times 1. The next term would contain, the integral would contain an x to the eighth. So I would get a factor of 7 times 5 times 3 times 1. So this is 2n factorial. Right? So this is our perturbation series. Our perturbation series has the form sum from n equals 0 to infinity, epsilon to the n, and then there's a minus 1 to the n. You notice there's this alternating sign. There is an n factorial in the bottom, n factorial because we've expanded the e to the epsilon times, e to the epsilon times x to the 4. Okay, and finally, there's a 4n minus 1 double factorial. Okay, are you all happy with that? So if you do perturbation theory for a quantum field theory, this is what you get. And the only difference between this quantum field theory and a real, honest-to-God quantum field theory in d dimensions is that these numbers are just a little bit different. They're much more difficult to calculate. We were able to calculate here all the terms in the perturbation series, all of them. There they are. Okay. And now we have to ask, what is 4n minus 1 double factorial? What is this thing? Okay, so this means 4n minus 1 double factorial means 4n minus 1 times 4n minus 3 times, and so on, all the way down to 1. Right? So can we turn this into an ordinary factorial? What we would have to do would be to multiply on the top by 4n and 4n minus 2, and 4n minus 4, and so on. That would turn it into a complete factorial. But it means we'd also have to put the same numbers in the bottom. So there are altogether, if we factor out a 2 out of all those numbers, we have 2 to the 2n. There are 2n factors altogether. And then we would have 2n minus 2,
and so on. So this gives us 4n factorial over 2 to the 2n, 2n factorial. 4n factorial. Sorry. Did I do that right? Yeah, I did it right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they're all together 2n factorials of 2. So that means this perturbation expansion here has the form sum from n equals 0 to infinity, epsilon to the n minus 1 to the n over n factorial, 4n factorial, divided by 2n factorial, and a factor of 2 to the 2n. Right there. That's the perturbation series that we've gotten. Okay? And we have, obviously, a disaster. And why do we have a disaster? Because let's do another calculation. How does this perturbation series converge or diverge? So we have to ask, what happens if n is very, very big? And remember that n factorial, by the Stirling formula for n factorial is roughly n to the n e to the minus n, times algebraic terms, which we don't care about too much. Okay? So let's approximate this. The numerator contains an epsilon to the n, a minus 1 to the n. 4n factorial would be 4n to the 4n power e to the minus 4n. Okay? And in the denominator, there's a 2 to the 2n, and there's an n factorial, which is n to the n e to the minus n, and a 2n factorial, which is 2n to the 2n power e to the minus 2n. Okay? Okay? Are you all with me? And that, apart from algebraic terms, this is the geometric behavior of the nth term in that perturbation series. Okay? Now, how does this behave? Well, to begin with, there's a minus 1 to the n and an epsilon to the n. That takes care of these terms. What about the powers of n? There's an n to the 4n on top and an n to the 3n on the bottom, which leaves on the top an n to the n. Then there are other factors, but these are geometric factors, which I don't care about very much, but I'll write them down. Okay? So from this term, I get a 4 to the 4n. And here is an e to the minus 4n, e to the minus 2n, e to the minus 2n. So that gives me e to the minus n. Okay? And in the denominator, you have, let's see, there's a 2 to the 2n, and here a 2 to the 2n, which looks like 2 to the 4n altogether, I guess. Right? So apart from factors of 2 here, this behaves like minus 1 to the n, epsilon to the n, and n to the n, e to the minus n, is n factorial. And then these other numbers, there's a 4 to the 4n and a 2 to the 4n. Doesn't matter, but that gives me a 2 to the 4n. So there's a constant to the n here. Do you see what we've got? We have a divergent series. And this is typical of any phi to the 4 calculation in any dimension of space-time. This is really, really serious, because this is what you calculate when you evaluate Feynman diagrams, and you see that the series diverges like n factorial. So the radius of convergence of this series is 0. Now, can you explain to me? Yeah, Tibra.
So the divergence of a realistic quantum field theory,
once that has been say renormalized, right. Is that so the same divergence as this?
Exactly the same. The only difference that where the dimension comes in is that it wouldn't be this constant to the n. This is 6 2 to the 4n is 16 to the power of n. And typically, it may not be 16 to the n, it may be some function of d to the n, but the key thing is the n factorial. So do you see what we've said? This series has a zero radius of convergence. That means that in the complex epsilon plane, there must be a singularity at zero. Can you tell me where that singularity is? What is the nature of that singularity? How do I know? Could I have told that right away? Could I have known right away that there must be a singularity at zero? How do I know that?
Just the character of your exponent changes as epsilon goes to zero.
As epsilon goes to zero. How do I know that it changes as epsilon goes to zero?
X to the 4.
It's negative.
Yeah. I mean, if I change the sign of epsilon, this becomes positive here. I'm thinking of epsilon as a positive number. If I change the sign of epsilon to make it negative, then this is a positive number in the exponent. So the integral stops converging. Okay? So in the complex epsilon plane, everything is okay with that integral when epsilon, here's the epsilon plane. It's okay on the real axis when epsilon is positive, but when epsilon is negative, for any negative value of epsilon, this integral is divergent. And that suggests that there is a cut over here, a branch cut in the complex plane. It's not a simple pole, it's a branch cut. So the function of epsilon that we're calculating has a singularity right at the origin, and we know this perturbation series must be divergent. Okay. Now, we need to discuss this. So this is just, I'm going to erase this. This is just a side calculation.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you about that.
Sorry.
I mean, that diverges for all epsilon, no?
Diverges for all epsilon, except for epsilon equals zero.
Yes. So why did you say that it diverges for epsilon equals zero?
No, except for epsilon equals zero. Except. Clearly, if I set epsilon exactly equal to zero, then this integral exists, okay? And if I set epsilon equals zero, this series converges. Because there isn't any series. There's only the first term in the series. Okay, only the first term survives because epsilon equals zero.
I thought you said that it diverges for epsilon equals zero.
No. It begins to diverge right here at epsilon equals zero as you go to the left. So there's a transition point right at epsilon equals zero. So technically speaking, this series exists, but it has a zero radius of convergence. And we're interested, of course, for epsilon positive. And you notice that we can't evaluate it. So again, this is how a field theory behaves. This is a toy field theory that we made up here. But this is typically how field theory behaves. The difference between what we did and what happens if you do a quantum field theory in two-dimensional space-time, four-dimensional space-time, the difference is that you only know a few terms in the series. Now, if we needed to sum this series, we could use Borel summation. Okay? And if you sum this series using Borel summation, you will get that integral. Okay? Why is that? Because the series is diverging like n factorial. And when you use Borel, you're dividing by an n factorial. You can then sum the series. You have an integral, and that integral will be precisely this integral. So if you use Borel summation, you'll get back the answer, okay? Which is really nice. However, that's unrealistic. Why is that unrealistic? And this is the point of this. We've come now to the key point in this course. Why is that unrealistic? Because in real life, you can't know an infinite number of terms in the perturbation series. All of the techniques that I showed you yesterday assumed that we know all of the terms in a divergent series. Okay, maybe in principle, in rare cases, you might know all the terms. But in real life, you may know the first three terms in a divergent series. Okay? If you have someone like Tibor or Dennis working, you know, you we could get them to do 10 terms before they get tired, but you know. But you only know a finite number of terms in the perturbation series, okay? And remember, when I showed you Euler or Borel or the generic technique of summing a divergent series, all of these techniques required that we had these series going all the way out to infinity, and we did some tricks. We summed the series out to infinity. But the real life problem is that you only know a finite number of terms. So we have a serious problem here. We have we only know a finite number of terms in the series. We know the series is divergent. What in the world do we do? And the general technique, what we will do, is use a continued function expansion. Okay? That is the usual, this is the general idea that you would use. And the question we have to decide on is which function are we going to continue, and what in the world do we mean even by a continued function expansion? Okay? So here is the philosophy. The philosophy is this. This integral that we've been playing with here, that integral exists on that line. Everything is okay if epsilon is positive. But when we expand that integral into a series in powers of epsilon, it no longer exists, or it doesn't converge. Okay? So the question is, can we first have tried to evaluate the integral, and we get the answer in the form of a formal Taylor series. But unfortunately, the Taylor series diverges. Can we then maneuver this Taylor series into another form, which maybe converges for the values of epsilon where we would like to know the answer? Okay. So I'm going to show you something peculiar, which you haven't learned, I assume. Okay. So let's take the following series. Okay. This is a really Okay, so here's the general sort of notation. We have a Taylor series, a sub n, x to the n. Okay, this Taylor series, let's say, is diverging. Either it's diverging because the radius of convergence of this Taylor series is zero, or even the radius of convergence may be bigger than zero, but we're trying to evaluate this at a value of x which is bigger, which is outside of the circle of convergence. So this series may converge in some circle here. This is where that series converges, but we want to evaluate it for that value of x, which is outside the circle of convergence. So we have to get there. We have to extend this representation to there. Okay? Now, so again, we have a hard problem as a function of x. We use perturbation theory to express the solution to the hard problem, let's say the answer to the hard problem as a function of x, as a Taylor series. We then want to evaluate this Taylor series outside of the circle of convergence. The circle of convergence may even be a point, as this case over here. This circle is reduced just to a single point. So we want to know it out there, where the Taylor series no longer converges. Okay, so what we are going to do is take some function or other and re-express this as an iterated continued function. So how might we do that? Well, suppose we want to use the function, say, e to the x. How would we continue e to the x? What do I mean by a continued function representation? Well, I might write this as b0 times e to the b1x times e to the b2x times e to the b3x times e to b4x and so on. Okay? That's a continued function, an iterated function. Okay? And it turns out, it's easy to show this, that if you know A0, you can, from A0, you know B0 in general. In fact, if you know A0, what is B0? What's B0? Once you know A0 in this case, what is B0?
A0.
It is A0. Okay. You know that B0 in this case is simply A0. How do you know that? You set x equal to 0. Okay? Now, if you know A0 and A1, from that, you know B0 and B1. And if you know A0, A1, and A2, you can find B0, B1, and B2, and so on. So the first n A's will determine the first n B's. Why would you do this? This is crazy. Why would you do this? The answer is because, unfortunately, Taylor series only converge in circles. But a continued exponential might possibly converge in a region that is bigger than a circle. Okay, and typically it does. In fact, typically, this continued exponential will converge in a region that looks like this, much, much bigger than a circle. So if you wanted to evaluate this series, say, at minus 3 over here, it may well be that minus 3 is inside of the region where the continued exponential converges. Hang on a second. What do I mean by the continued exponential converging? What I mean is that if you evaluate the sequence b0, b0 e to the x b1, b0 e to the x b1 e to the x b2, and so on, you evaluate that sequence, this sequence may converge to a limit, even though the Taylor series doesn't. So what have I done? I say, this representation of the function is fine. We derived it using perturbation theory, but it doesn't converge. So I then re-represent the Taylor series in a different form where it might converge. So I've chosen this because I've worked out a really, really amazing example where you can see it happening. Okay, really amazing example. So let's, as a specific case, let's take A sub n. This is quite astonishing, but let's take A sub n to be n plus 1 to the n minus 1 power over n factorial. Okay? This took a lot of guesswork. Okay? But suppose we do that. Can you guess what the b's come out to be? Say it again?
One.
You're right. All the b's, b sub n, all the b's are 1. So in other words, for the series sum from 0 to infinity, x to the n, n plus 1 to the n minus 1 over n factorial, that Taylor series, when it converges, is equal to e to the x, e to the x, e to the x, e to the x, and so on. By the way, you might play with this. If you like experimental mathematics, I would love to know another example. But I don't. This is the only one I could find for a continued exponential. So the question is, can you find a different set of coefficients here where there's a closed form expression for those coefficients, for the A's, and a closed form expression for the B's? I don't know one. Don't know one. That's the only one I know. But now let me show you what the picture looks like. Okay, so here's the point. If we don't know all the terms in a perturbation series, we only know a finite number of terms, let's try to convert the Taylor series, the formal Taylor series that diverges, into a continued function representation. So here we go. So if you take this Taylor series and you write it in this form, I guess I wrote Cn here and An here. Here is the formula. So if you know the Cs, C0 is A0. C1 is A1, A0. Okay? C2 is this expression. C3, you can see it's getting more and more complicated, but this is just simple algebra. Okay? So if you know the Cs, you can calculate the A's uniquely. Okay? And in this case, the A's are all 1. Okay? And so I played with this formula for a while and came up with that. Maybe you could play with it and come up with something else that's very clever. I'd love to know another example. Yeah?
Is there a recursion problem?
Is there? No, there isn't any simple recursion. I mean, there is one, of course, but it's not a finite size. It involves summation, you know, convolutions over n. So you can see that it's getting longer and longer. So it's not a simple recursion form. Okay? So here you go. That's the conversion. Now let me show you what it looks like. If you so this is what I just wrote on the board. Okay. If you ask where does the Taylor series converge, the Taylor series converges in this little circle. And the radius of this little circle is 1 over e. So the radius of this little circle is about 0.37. That's all. It's very, very tiny. But the continued fraction, the continued exponential, converges in this big heart-shaped region, which is really interesting. And different continued functions, you might have a continued square root, you might have a continued logarithm, you might have a continued anything. And each different continued function, in other words, you might have b0 times log of 1 plus b1x, log of 1 plus b2x, log of 1 plus b3, and so on. Each different function has a different region of convergence. Yeah?
So this looks like the primary region of the Mandelbrot set.
You bet it does.
Is there a connection?
That certainly is. This is an iterated function. Okay, so I'm going to show you something. You're going to see it in just a second. So this is where, so in other words, if you wanted to evaluate the original Taylor series at minus 2, you can't use the Taylor series here. You're outside the radius of convergence. But you're inside the cardioid. So do you see the pattern? It's absolutely straightforward. You don't know the answer to a problem, so you expand it in a Taylor series. That Taylor series, in this case, happens to converge in this circle. But you want to know the answer at minus 2, let's say. What do? You rewrite the Taylor series as a continued exponential. And remember, you only know a finite number of terms in the continued exponential, because the conversion from a Taylor series to a continued exponential is done term by term. Not using one of our tricks that I taught you yesterday, where we needed to know all the numbers in the series. Here we only have a finite number of numbers, and it's converging inside of that cardioid. So here's an interesting diversion, and I thought I would show you this picture because it's so pretty. So I asked an undergraduate student in my university, and I said to him, here's a nice project for you. He asked me, do I have a research project? So I said, okay, here's a nice project for you. Outside of this cardioid, clearly, the continued exponential diverges. Okay, it converges inside the cardioid. Outside the cardioid, it doesn't converge, so it diverges. But there are two ways in which a sequence can diverge. Okay, there are many ways in which a sequence could diverge. For example, the sequence could just get bigger, the numbers in the sequence could get bigger and bigger and bigger, and could run off to infinity. Okay? And that is actually what doesn't happen. This is another way in which it could diverge. It could just bounce around, like minus 1, plus 1, minus 1, plus 1. Okay, in that case, it would be approaching something having period 2. Or it could approach something having period 3. It could go boom, 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 boom. Or it could have period 4 or period 5. And the question is, if we look in the complex plane outside the cardioid, the question is, what does the sequence of truncated continued exponentials look like? And this is what it looks like. So what the student did was to program his computer and run for about 2 months. Okay, so for each pixel on his computer, he iterated that continued exponential to see what happened. And this is what he found. It's absolutely magnificent. This absolutely beautiful, beautiful picture. Okay. I gave him a big hug when he was done, because this is really great. So what you see here, let me explain what you see here. This is the upper half complex plane. The lower half complex plane is just a reflection of the upper half complex plane. So I only need to show you the upper half complex plane. And this right here is the cardioid. Okay, so the cardioid is coming out like this, going around, and then it's coming all the way down here. You can't see it, okay? Coming back again and coming in like that. So dark blue, this dark blue color, means that the continued exponential is converging. Outside of this cardioid, it isn't converging, but you notice there are a whole bunch of different colors. Red means that it's converging to a two-cycle. So it's converging to something that goes boom, 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 like that. And that's red. And the other colors correspond to converging to a three-cycle, four-cycle, five-cycle, six-cycle, and so on. Black means that his computer couldn't tell. That is, he had a cutoff if the computer ran for more than a half an hour or something like that, and he couldn't see the pattern, then it was just black. It didn't mean that it diverges. It just means that it's more than a 12-cycle. I think there are 12 different colors here. Okay, so, and if you look at this, for example, this is where it converges to a 3-cycle, this is maybe a 4-cycle, 5-cycle, 6-cycle, and so on. Okay, you notice that there is one bump, one indentation in the cardioid. That's reflected over here, if you look at this, for example, to many indentations. You know, for here's the indentation, and this is periodic. It's not periodic, it's almost periodic as you go off to imaginary infinity. And there are all these beautiful indentations here that are reflections of this blue indentation. They're consequences of this blue indentation. Okay, and you notice that this is sort of shaped, it gets fat on one side and it gets thin on the other side. And you notice that it seems to end in a little crescent. But it doesn't end. It's just that his computer got tired. Okay? What actually happens is that this looks like a tadpole with an infinitely long tail. Okay? So what happens is this tail gets longer and longer and longer, thinner and thinner and thinner. In fact, it gets exponentially thin, and it runs off to infinity parallel to the real axis, which is right here. And in fact, every single one of these pictures is a tadpole with an infinitely long tail. So for example, you see that there's a little blue patch over here with a bunch of indentations on it. If you follow it along, the tail of the tadpole comes through here, through this hole, through this opening here, comes around and comes out to infinity. And it runs parallel to the tails of all these little tadpoles here. And there are an infinite number of green tadpoles. And then there are an infinite number of little blue tadpoles here. And each of these, you see, so this has a repetitive structure, okay, like a renormalization group structure. And so just the way these blue things have blue tails coming out that are coming in between these yellow tails here, this pair of blue comes in between this pair of yellow tails and comes out here, and this pair of blue comes in between this little pair of yellow tails and comes out, and so on and so on and so on. So what you end up with is an infinite number of tails all getting exponentially thin and running off to infinity parallel to the real axis. And all the tails find their way out. So for example, you see this little white, it's not white, it's sort of light pink or something, light purple. This comes out through here, comes out through here, out, and then comes around and runs off to infinity like that. Okay, so each of these regions is actually an infinite region. So if this is, I don't remember exactly what the color scheme is, but if this is a five cycle, that five cycle, the tail runs all the way off to infinity as a five cycle. Okay. In fact, one thing we don't know the answer to is there anything except, I mean, we have all these n cycles here. Is there any place where things just blow up, don't become a cycle, just actually blow up? And on the real axis, that seems to be the case. But apart from the real axis, in the complex plane, does anything blow up? Or does it always become an end cycle? I don't know the answer to that question. Very interesting, very fancy geometry here. This is absolutely amazing geometry. Okay? Yeah?
Expecting something like from based on some other argument where you were expecting to
see something like this?
No, well, were you expecting to see different cycles like in different regions?
Yeah, I sort of was, okay, because this has a, you can see this has a fractal structure, a repetitive structure, and that's, you know, when you play with chaotic structures, fractal structures, you see stuff like this. Of course, you could just as easily have done, you know, a continued logarithm. You could have written, you know, log of 1 plus x times log of 1 plus x times log of 1 plus x times, like that, right? And I would expect you'd see the same thing, but same basic thing, but I don't know what the structure would look like. Interested in a project? Okay, computers work faster now, so you might be able to draw a picture of this pretty quickly. Okay, and there's an infinite number of functions. Instead of log, you could have taken square root. So you could have had an iterated square root, and you could have seen how the square root behaves, and studied the region in which the square root converges, which is, of course, not going to be a circle. It's typically only a circle for a Taylor series. But when you convert a Taylor series to a continued function, then you end up with some strange, beautiful picture like this. You have to agree, this is really beautiful. It's really amazing. Yeah?
So how you started with some coefficient 10 x to the n here, and then
right.
You went to some...
That's because, remember, that's because we're doing perturbation theory.
Right. So would you always start with that, and then... But or if I wanted to do a continued log, would that come from a similar series or would it come from a different series? Like,
we always begin with a Taylor series, and then we push the Taylor series into the form of a continued logarithm because we hope that the continued logarithm will converge as a sequence where the original Taylor series did not.
So you have to guess the coefficient?
Right. There's a lot of art.
So you guess the coefficient specific to the type of continued function that you want.
Right, right. And so there's a tremendous amount of art. And I am now on the frontier of what is known, because I don't know the answer to these questions. So there's, once you, you know, you may have invested a year of your life calculating six terms in a perturbation series. You don't want to waste that year of your life, so you can play with different things. But now I'm going to tell you about the one thing that has been investigated in great detail. Do you know what that is? There's one iterated function that has really been studied in great detail, and that's what I'm going to talk to you about. Do you know what that is?
No.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Instead of entering a cycle, are there regions where it becomes chaotic?
Becomes chaotic. Well, that's the question. I don't... Oh.
I know that you.
Is there some place where well. It simply is not a cycle at all?
Yes.
Where it's just bouncing around.
Yes.
And
no.
Not necessarily running off to infinity, but just bouncing around in a noisy way. And the answer is we didn't find one, and we don't know. Okay. So that would be an interesting question, and I don't know the answer to that. Okay. The question is: are these regions, colored regions, where you have n cycles, are they dense? Is there a set of measure zero, for example, where things are chaotic? Or is there even a region which is not a set of measure zero, that is a set of finite extent where you have chaos? And I don't know. I just don't know the answer. Okay. Yeah.
So my function Taylor expanded around the origin. I've got a pole at one, so I've got radius of convergence one. Is that like there's no continued function expansion that would give me the function 2, is there?
Oh, no, that's precisely what we did yesterday. Remember, we summed the series 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus 8 plus 16 by writing down, we interpreted that as the Taylor series 1 plus 2x plus 4x squared, plus 8x cubed, and so on. And we summed that Taylor series. And we didn't even bother to write it as a continued function because we knew all the terms in the series, so we just summed it up. And that the sum of that series was just, you know, just a simple pole, 1 over 1 minus 2x. Okay? And that function, while the series did not exist, say, at x equals 1, that function, 1 over 1 plus 2x, did exist at x equals 1. And the answer was 1 over 1 minus 2, or minus 1. And if there was an unambiguous, no matter how we got to the point at x equals 1, we got an unambiguous, unique answer by analytic continuation. So that's an example. So indeed, there are lots of continued functions where you could just go past the singularity, go round the singularity.
So not all of them are shaped like the continued expansion.
Oh, I don't know what they're all shaped like. I mean, there may be different funny shapes. Now, a cardioid is a very typical shape, but there are other things that which look like double cardioids. Okay, I experimented with continued exponentials for a while. And you could have things that instead of coming around like this and having an indentation and then coming around like that, you can have a continued exponential that converges in a double cardioid that comes around like this, has two indentations, and then comes around like this. Okay? And you can find one that has three indentations. It comes around like this, indentation, indentation, indentation. Okay. So it looks like a clover leaf. Okay? It's very pretty. It's really quite remarkable. Okay, but now I'm going to show you. And we're now getting... So this is all utterly unexplored territory. I mean, essentially nothing is known about this. So if you want to do a project and look at any of this, bang, this is all essentially all fresh and new and interesting stuff. But now I'm going to tell you about the one iterated function that really has been studied by many people and in great detail, and it's this. And it's called continued a continued fraction, and that is what, this is the most, if you walk up to a mathematical physicist, they will say the key thing that we have to look at is a continued fraction. And that has been studied by many mathematicians and many theoretical physicists, mathematical physicists, for quite a few years, for the last half century. A lot of work has been done, and I'm going to tell you about this. And that is the technique that I'm going to use to sum this series here. Okay, so don't forget, we have arrived at an interesting series here. So I have a way that I like to explain continued fractions, and it's a really peculiar way. So I don't think you'll find this in a course that you take. But I enjoy talking about it this way. So the way I like to explain continued fractions is, have you ever taken an IQ test? Okay. And in an IQ test, one of the typical questions they ask you is, what is the next number in the sequence? Okay. And you have to tell me what is the next number. So, I mean, you know what I'm talking about, right? So if I give you the sequence 14, 34, 42, 72, 96, what's the next number? Nobody knows? Well, I'll tell you the answer. It's 125. Because these are the stops, these are the express stops on the 7th Avenue going uptown in Manhattan. Okay. So, all right. So I'll try to ask you. I'll give you a different question. So, consider something a little bit more mathematical. What if I gave you the sequence 1, 5, 61? Does anybody? This is a serious. I'm not joking this time. Anybody know that? Does anybody recognize these numbers? Anybody know anything about number theory?
Can you give us one more?
Sure. You say, oh! You're supposed to say, of course. Okay, this is a very famous sequence of numbers. These are called the Euler numbers. And you can read about them if you're interested. Okay. But if somebody walked up to you on the street and said, would you please tell me the next number in this sequence, I think you would be hard-pressed to do that. This would not be easy to do. So I'm going to give you a trick that doesn't always work, of course, for guessing the next number in a sequence. Okay? So let's call these numbers A sub n. Okay, so in other words, this is A0, this is A1, this is A2, this is A3, and so on. So in other words, someone gives you a sequence of numbers somebody gives you a sequence of numbers AN, and you're trying to find the next number in this sequence. And this is a very hard problem because these numbers are typically growing very, very rapidly. Okay, so this is very tricky. In fact, if you try to estimate how fast these numbers are growing, very roughly, these numbers are growing like a constant to the n times 2n factorial. That's how fast the Euler numbers are growing. So since they're growing so fast, these are not easy to recognize. And these don't factor, or they don't have simple, you know, prime factorizations or anything like that. These are very, very hard numbers to guess. Of course, you can derive them, in the form of a Taylor series, a formal Taylor series. But that Taylor series, of course, will not converge. Okay. So here's a trick. And the trick for finding these numbers consists of three parts. Okay, and they're very simple. The idea is very, very simple. So, three steps. What I'm going to do is I'm going to convert these numbers to a different sequence of numbers, which I'm going to call B sub n. And B sub n are going to be a sequence of numbers which are very easy to guess. And then having guessed the numbers BN, we're going to transform back again. Okay. Now, this should remind you of stuff you already know, right? How did we solve the heat equation? We were given a partial differential equation. Okay. We were given a partial differential equation, and how did we solve the partial differential equation? We used a Fourier transformation. That is, we introduced a Fourier representation. And we got an ordinary differential equation satisfied by the Fourier coefficients. We then solve that simple equation and then transform, plug it back into the Fourier series, which in effect transforming back to the hard problem. So in other words, I want you to imagine that we have here a hard problem, guessing the next A sub n. We do some sort of transformation to an easy problem for guessing the next number in the sequence B, and then we transform back again to the hard problem, and we know the answer. Okay? Interestingly, the transformation that I'm going to show you is a nonlinear transformation. Fourier, you do that in the theater, and they get really angry at you. So, you know, when you do a Fourier transform, that's linear. And this is nonlinear. Okay? So, what's the technique? So, the technique is going to consist of three steps. And each of the three steps is very, very easy. So, here's step one. So, step one, I want you to imagine that the numbers a sub n can be written as the nth moment, actually we'll take it to be the 2nth moment, of some function, which we could call a weight function. Okay? So imagine that the numbers a sub n could be written as the 2nth moment of some weight function w of x. Okay, now let me tell you what I'm not asking you to do. I am not asking you to find w of x. That would be hopeless. You can't do that. That's called solving the moment problem. So I didn't ask you to find w. Okay, I wouldn't do that. I asked you to imagine that a sub n could be written in that form. That's all. So are you done imagining? Good. Okay. And of course, you know, the integral dx w of x is equal to 1. So it's a normalized weight function. And you see why that's true, because we said that the zeroth number in the series is 1. And we'll take it in general. We'll take it to be 1. Okay? So we've now completed step one of the process. And that wasn't very hard. Okay? So all you had to do is to imagine something. Okay? Also, by the way, we don't know the number L. But that's OK, because you're imagining that there's a number L there. All right? OK, so here's step two. Imagine for a moment that you knew the numbers BN. Suppose we knew the numbers bn. What could you do with them? Well, you could write them on a piece of notebook paper and throw it out, or you could do something constructive. You could use those numbers bn to construct a set of polynomials just for fun. So how would you do that? You would say, imagine that the zeroth polynomial is defined to be 1, okay? And the first polynomial is defined to be x, and that the nth polynomial, pn plus 1, satisfies a recursion relation. And in this case, there's going to be a simple recursion relation. So p sub n plus 1 is x times pn, okay, minus bn times pn minus 1. Okay? So with a recursion relation of this type, if you knew the numbers b, we don't know the numbers b. Okay? We don't know them. But if we did know them, you could imagine constructing a set of polynomials. So in fact, just for laughs, let's do the first, you know, we know P0, we know P1, that's just a definition. So what would P2 be? So you set You said, here. Okay, so you set n equal to 1 in this recursion relation, right? And you get p2 is equal to x times p1, which is x, minus b1 times p0 here. Okay, which is 1. So this is x squared minus b1. Okay? And then we could keep going. P3 would be x times x squared minus b1. That's p2, right? Minus b2 times p1, which is x. Okay? So this is x cubed minus b1 plus b2 times x. And you could keep doing this. You could keep playing.
Sorry, I must be what's a?
Okay, let me say it again. Suppose we knew the numbers bn. Okay? Just imagine for a moment that we had this set of numbers bn. We don't know them yet. Just imagine we did. Okay? Then I'm going to define a set of polynomials P sub n of x, okay? P0 is 1, by definition. P1 is x, always, by definition, okay? And in general, the nth polynomial, the Pn plus 1 polynomial as a function of x, is defined to be x times the previous polynomial minus Bn times the one before that. So we have a recursion relation. And I'm just using that recursion relation to calculate these polynomials. Of course, we don't know the b's, so this is silly. Okay, but we've only finished step two. Okay, so these are the. And do you agree with me at least that you could trivially, just on the back of an envelope, you can calculate p4 and p5 until you get tired? Okay. Okay, so that was step two. All right. So the interesting step is step three. Can you imagine, can you guess what I'm going to do now? I mean, what I've said, think about it for a second. What I've said is if you know the a's, you could imagine that the a's are the nth moment of some unknown function. And if you knew the b's, you could use those b's to create a set of polynomials. So there doesn't seem to be any connection between the a's and the b's. How do I impose a connection between the a's and the b's? Very interesting. I'm going to require that these polynomials are an orthogonal set of polynomials, and that they are orthogonal with respect to the weight function w. Okay? These are not necessarily orthogonal polynomials, they're just polynomials. But I want them to be orthogonal polynomials with respect to w. So what do I mean by that? So for example, it must be that p0 is orthogonal to p2. P0 is clearly orthogonal to p1, okay, because p0 is an even function, p1 is an odd function, and if you integrate from minus l to l, this automatically vanishes. And I'm assuming that the weight function is an even function of x. Okay? But p0 is not obviously orthogonal to p2, but I'm going to require it. So I'm going to require that p sub n, these set of polynomials, is an orthogonal set of polynomials. So for example, if I require that p0 is orthogonal to p2, what I mean is that if I integrate from minus l to l, dx, w of x, because it's orthogonal with respect to w, and I plug in p0, which is, you know, p0, which is just 1, and p2, which is just written here, which is just x squared minus b1, okay, that this must be equal to 0. But we already know how to evaluate the integral of w times x squared. What is that? A1, okay, by our definition, A1. And this one is the integral of W of x times B1, which is B1. So that's equal to 0. So we have concluded that A1 equals B1. Okay? Now, let's see. We could require that P1 is orthogonal to P3. That would be a non-trivial requirement. So that means that the integral with respect to, you know, the integral with over W times P1 times P3. Now, P3 is written down. P3 is x cubed minus B1 plus B2 times x. And I have to multiply this by P1, which is x, that this has to be 0 in order for those polynomials to be orthogonal. And therefore, the first integral gives me the integral of x to the 4 times w, which is a2. And the second integral gives me minus b1 plus b2 times the integral of x squared, which is a1, which is equal to 0. Do you all see? This is pretty simple stuff. So therefore, since we know that a1, we just learned that a1 over here is b1, we now know that a2 is equal to b1 plus b2 times b1. And remember I told you before that the transformation between the numbers a sub n and b sub n is a nonlinear transformation. It's not like a Fourier transform, which is linear. Okay, the Fourier transform of twice a function is twice the Fourier transform. It's linear. Okay, but this is nonlinear, as you can see. Okay, and I'll tell you what the next one is. You can work it out. Okay, the next one is a3 is equal to b1, b2, b3 plus b1 times b1 plus b2 squared. And you can keep going. You can keep calculating. Okay? Are you with me? So now, let's go back, just for laughs, let's go back and look at this very, very weird series here. Okay? So, A1, so what I would like to do is I'm going to take this and I'm going to call this just A1 here, and this A2, and this A3, and this A4. And I'm going to put in A1 to begin with, call this A0. Okay. Actually, well, we don't even have to do this. We can just leave off the A. This is fine. Okay. So I look over here, and if A1 is 1, B1 is 1. Okay, so the first number in this sequence for B, this B1 over here, is just 1. Now, A2, we said, is 5. B2 is 5. A1 is 1, so B1 is 1. So that says that B2 is 4. Okay. Now, go down to this formula here. Okay. Remember, B1 we know is 1, and B2 is 4. So this thing over here is 1 times 1 plus 4 squared, which is 25, right? And 60, A3 is 61. It's a weird number, 61. But if you subtract 25 from 61, you get 36. 36 divided by 1 times 4 is 9. So B3 is 9. OK? Okay. And can you fill in the blank? Yeah, you think it's 16, do you? Well, you're right. 16, 25, and so on. And you can guess these numbers here. And in fact, this is very interesting because typically, if the numbers, if the a's grow like 2n factorial times some constant to the n, the b's grow much, much more slowly. The b's only grow like n squared. If the a's grow like n factorial times some constant to the n, then the b's just grow like n. So the b's are a sequence of numbers that is much, much, much better behaved, much more controlled. Okay. Now, of course, you know the next b, and you can go back and calculate the next a, and you'll get the right answer. That's where the 1385 comes from. Hang on a second. Before, okay, so this is really what I've been talking about is almost fantasy mathematics. So the question is, what are we talking about here? And now let me show you, okay, because I think this is a really cool way, I think, in my opinion, of explaining. I said that I was going to explain continued fractions, and I haven't said anything about fractions or continued or anything like this. So the question is, what am I talking about here? And here's the answer. Suppose you had a Taylor series of the form a sub n x to the n, sum from 0 to infinity, and we're assuming that a0 is 1. Okay, the overall, I mean, the first term of the series, we'll just assume without loss of generality is 1. Okay? Suppose I write this as a continued fraction. The form of that continued fraction would be 1 over 1 minus b1 x over 1 minus b2 x over 1 minus b3 x over, and so on. Those are the a's that we imagined over here, and these are the b's. And that's the connection between the a's and the b's. It's absolutely beautiful. Continued fractions have a deep connection with orthogonal polynomials. Okay, and that is the connection. Okay, so if you want to see it happening, let me show you that it's happening. If you truncate this continued fraction after the term 1 over 1 minus b1x, and you expand that into a Taylor series, that Taylor series would begin 1 plus b1x, and you compare that with this Taylor series that reads 1 plus a1x and so on. You compare these two Taylor series, and you conclude that a1 equals b1. Okay? Is that clear? Now, suppose we truncated here after two iterations of the continued fraction. Then this would be 1 over 1 minus b1x over 1 minus b2x. Okay? You all understand? Okay, I'll be done in just a second. We put this, we rationalize this. And we get 1 minus b2x over 1 minus b2x minus b1x. Okay, just multiply the top and the bottom by 1 minus b2. Okay? Expand this into a Taylor series. So this is 1 minus b2x. And the expansion of the denominator in a geometric series would be 1 plus b1 plus b2x plus b1 plus b2 squared x squared plus and so on. Do you all agree? Right? And if we multiply this out, you get first term is 1 plus b1 plus b2x plus b1 plus b2 squared x squared. And then we have minus b2x, okay, which would be minus b2x times this, minus b2 times b1 plus b2x squared, right, plus higher powers of x. Do you all see this? Right? Which is 1 plus b1x, just as before, the b2's cancel, just as before, plus, and when you simplify this, you get B1 times B1 plus B2 x squared. Okay? Which is precisely the formula over here. So A2 is B1 plus B2 times B1. Okay? So if you Taylor expand this continued fraction, and you set the coefficients of this continued fraction equal to the coefficients in this Taylor series, you will arrive at a set of nonlinear relations here, and those are precisely the nonlinear relations that solve your IQ test problem. Okay? So that's the connection between a Taylor series and a continued fraction. And now let me tell you what happens. Okay, so this is the bottom line, and that's what we're going to see tomorrow. This is what I claim. The Taylor series, typically, a Taylor series converges in a circle. Typically, a continued fraction converges in the entire complex plane except for one line. Do you remember the problem we started talking about today? Can you remember back that far? I started talking about something. And I said that that integral that I wrote on the board here was perfectly, remember I said it was perfectly okay, but it wasn't okay on the negative axis. Because that's where the integral did not diverge. But for all other values of epsilon, it converged. Okay? The Taylor series has a zero radius of convergence. But the continued exponential converges everywhere in the entire complex plane except on the negative axis. So, this is the procedure for solving a quantum field theory or for solving any kind of perturbation problem. Okay, we have to show that. We haven't showed it yet. But, number one, you're given a hard problem. Number two, you do perturbation theory and you end up with a formal Taylor series, and that formal Taylor series diverges. Using this simple set of algebraic relations, you convert the A sub n's, which are the perturbation coefficients, into B sub n's, and you plug it into this continued fraction. Now, this continued fraction is a sequence of numbers. The first number is 1, the next number is 1 over 1 plus B1x, the next number is 1 over 1 minus B1x over 1 minus B2x, and so on. That sequence of numbers converges everywhere in the entire complex plane. Everywhere. And I haven't shown it to you yet, but typically for physically reasonable problems like quantum field theories, not only does it converge, but it converges to the right answer. What do I mean by the right answer? The answer that you would get if you had evaluated the original integral. Okay, so now you're beginning to see why I'm giving you this course. Because now, for the first time, you are powerful. Okay? Until now, you were strong because you could calculate lots and lots of terms in a perturbation series. But after you finished the calculation, it was worthless because you could not get the answer out. And now what I'm telling you is you can get the answer out, and by taking more and more perturbative more and more coefficients in the perturbation series, you can get closer and closer to the answer. Okay? That's what this course is basically about. And this is the kind of, this is the summation theory we're going to use. Of course, how do we know it works, and what is known rigorously? That's what I'm going to tell you about for the next few days. Yeah?
You mentioned when you're truncated.
Yep. That's one of the amazing things. I'll give you I'll give you more than a one-word answer. Yup isn't a word, actually, but I'll give you more than a one-word answer. The answer is yes for a very large but special class of functions. That is to say, we will not only have an approximate answer, but we will have an upper and lower bound on the error of that answer. Amazing. That's correct. Yeah.
Here you said that all of P n's are orthogonal, but you only use like P n and P PMS too. So
right.
Because otherwise you get like contradictory.
Good. That's a wonderful question. Okay. Wait. Did everybody hear the question? Because this is a really wonderful question. Wonderful question.
Can you say it once again?
Okay. So let me repeat the question. This is a very, very insightful question. What I did over here was I said, let's calculate the polynomials. And the calculation of the polynomials is straightforward because I'm just iterating this recursion relation. Okay? But then I wanted to find the relationship between A and B. So I said, well, if they're orthogonal, P0 has to be orthogonal to P2. And that gave me the first relation. Then I said, P1 has to be orthogonal to P3. That gave me the next one. But as I get more and more polynomials, there will be many different requirements of orthogonality. For example, when I've got, when I have all the way from P0 up to P6, okay, then I can require that P1 is orthogonal to P5, that P0, for example, is orthogonal to P6, but also that P2 is orthogonal to P4, right? And as I have more and more polynomials, the number of orthogonality relations is growing very, very rapidly, right? When I know P10, when I've gone all the way up to P10, P0 has to be orthogonal to P10, P1 to P9, P2 to P8, P3 to P7, and so on. So I have many, many conditions. So maybe these algebraic relations will be overdetermined. They're not. Okay? And it's not obvious, but in fact, if you go, I can give you a place to read. You can read about the theory of orthogonal polynomials. In fact, they are not overdetermined. They are uniquely determined. That's not obvious. It's not obvious, but this is a generically true statement about orthogonal polynomials. Okay? That if you create a set of orthogonal polynomials using a three-term recursion relation, this requirement of orthogonality, that Pn is orthogonal to Pm, if n is not equal to m, is never overdetermined. Okay, and it will give you a single set of relationships, and once you know this relationship, say it's from requiring that P0 is orthogonal to P10, P9 will already be orthogonal to P1, and P8 will already be orthogonal to P2, and P7 will already be orthogonal to P3. Okay, and I'll show you in detail how that's working. I can show you, after class, so we can go through the algebra. But that automatically works. The worry, of course, is that you will get something that's overdetermined, and the game will end. But it doesn't end. This is really how it works. Okay. Okay. Should we?
Yeah.
Call it. One last question. Should we take one last question?
This is,
yeah. Sure.
Is
yeah.
it useful to connect this thing to Hilbert spaces, assuming a real time problem?
Connect it to a Sturm-Liouville problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we can talk about that. Yes, because these polynomials are orthogonal, and therefore these polynomials are complete in some Hilbert space. And indeed, there is a Sturm-Liouville problem for which these polynomials are the eigenfunctions. There may be a Sturm-Liouville problem. Okay. However, it's not guaranteed that the polynomials will set. It's not guaranteed. It sometimes happens that these are what is called the classical orthogonal polynomial, which satisfy a differential equation in Sturm-Liouville problem. In general, however, these polynomials don't satisfy a finite dimensional, nth order differential equation. In general, the polynomials are orthogonal and are complete in some Hilbert space. But in general, they don't have to. They can if they're the classical polynomials, but they don't have to satisfy a differential equation. Okay? They only do if they're called, when they do, they're called classical polynomials. They may also not satisfy a differential equation, they may satisfy a difference equation. And those are the classical discrete polynomials, but they may satisfy neither. Okay? But they're still complete in Hilbert space. Okay, shall we die? Yeah, let's die. Okay, we'll start tomorrow.